major military powers are betting big on emerging defence technologies. The good news, Europe is leading in many research areas. The bad news, it's behind on turning discoveries into actual capabilities. And this is not a race we can afford to lose, can we, Mike?
No, and it's one of the perennial problems of defence technologies that, you know, we can see what the new technologies are, like genetic sciences, nanotechnologies, material science, shape-shifting. And the point is, we all know that some aspects of these novel technologies will be weaponized by somebody, maybe not by us, but we've got to understand them in order to understand how they might be weaponized.
It's really important that it's being done at a NATO alliance level so we could be developing countermeasures to those technologies.
Defence Explained.
We need people who are active in the field to inform what's happening in the lab.
This is SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So, we wanted to talk emerging tech this week because of a big budget boost to a NATO programme aimed at keeping us ahead of potential enemies. The Defence Innovation Accelerator, known as NATO Diana, offers money and practical support to help firms develop potential technologies for defence. Last year, for example, it backed a London-based firm, Cogitat, developing AI which can decode brainwaves read by a headset. That support took the project from early laboratory validation to a prototype demonstration in simulators at Estonia's Aviation Academy. Mike, this is just one example, but it's something you and I have talked about before. Thought control by pilots is a core concept for the next generation of RAF jets, GCAP, for example. Things that have sounded like science fiction in the past are now a reality, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And that's the point. You know, we're going from sort of fourth now to sixth generation air power in GCAP. Fourth generation is, you know, the Typhoon. And we're already trying to, the scientists are already trying to apply some of these new technologies into Typhoon that then will be transferred through, you know, via the F-35, which is fifth generation, into GCAP, which is the sixth generation, which will be Tempest. And it's all about not having to fly the aircraft. The pilot, he or she, should not have to worry about what the aircraft is doing, nor indeed just putting the aircraft where they want it to be. The pilot will actually be deciding on how to fight the battle. So the pilot will be taking, if you like, as it were, tactical battle decisions. And the aircraft and the drones that fly with it, Brontanax looks like the drone which is presently being developed that will fly with GCAP, they will actually decide for themselves how they will manipulate their mechanical surfaces to fly where they need to be. So it's taking the pilot right out of the job of flying an aircraft, except possibly in takeoff and landing. But once it's in combat mode, the pilot just makes command decisions, doesn't have to actually pilot anything. That's new generation thinking.
And if we look at another example, something that already exists in huge numbers, small drones, thousands of them flying over Ukraine every day. But not all small drones are equal. Their sensors, processors and batteries determine how well they see, the decisions they can make and how long they can fly. The point here, Mike, is soldiers on the battlefield shouldn't need to think about the components that make up the drone, but someone has to.
Exactly. And the somebody who has got to be, if you like, conceptually near the battlefield all the time, because these things are going to be improved, you know, as we've seen in Ukraine, in a matter of, you know, days and weeks. And the Ukrainians are putting stuff onto the front line that's only 50% effective, and they know that, and people are paying with their lives for the lack of testing, but that's war, and then the thing comes back and is improved until it's 80% effective, 90% effective. What we can't do anymore is wait until something is 98, 99% effective until we field it. We know that we're going to have to field systems which are tested on the battlefront, in war. That was the situation in the Second World War. As you say, somebody has to think about these things, but conceptually, they've got to be as near to the front as they can be, even if physically they're sitting 1,000 miles away.
And that is why the NATO Innovation Accelerator, DIANA, exists, to focus thinking and support on the technologies that allies say they need, although they could be dual use. Approved in 2021 and operating since 2023, DIANA has a budget in the tens of millions of pounds. It's not huge in defence terms, but not insignificant. And next year, it's getting a 20% increase. Well, let's bring in Emma Baker, Senior Defence Advisor at the industry body ADS. Emma, great to meet you. Welcome to SITREP.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on.
So, Emma, in layman's terms, how does DIANA work on a practical level?
It's essentially a business accelerator. And so it's looking at how NATO as an alliance can identify, develop and then adopt cutting edge technologies. It has a specific focus on dual use technologies as well. And it aims to try and help companies, particularly SMEs and startups that might be struggling to move from the lab phase into sort of operational use. And so it gives access to testing facilities, it gives mentoring access, it helps provide access to funding opportunities, and also that direct engagement with defence users as well. And it has sort of 90 or so test centres across the alliance. And it focuses on sort of particular technology areas. So it's looked at AI, it's looked at quantum technologies, it's looked at advanced materials, biotechnology, energy systems and things like that to try and help pull these technologies through into warfighters' hands.
And practically, how does it actually accelerate the development of new technologies?
Part of it's through funding and through grants. Part of it is through access to testing environments as well, so they can sort of develop and test and trial these technologies. And part of it's through the exposure to NATO and to the other allies in order to help provide that linkage through into other nations so that they have that network building through so that things are not just being looked at a national level, but at an alliance level as well.
And Emma, selected projects get up to €100,000 support. That doesn't sound like much when we talk about spending billions on ships and planes, but how much difference can that £100,000 make to each firm trying to turn a cutting-edge concept into actual action?
It does make a difference. And you're right that in defence terms, this doesn't feel like a huge amount of money. But if you're a small SME or a startup, that can provide quite significant support. But it is also about that wider network of support that it provides, not just the financial contribution. And so the mentoring, the business support, the exposure that it gives, the ability to partake in sort of NATO trials and exercises and that kind of experimentation activity is also really valuable alongside the financial support.
Mike, we've seen Ukraine demonstrate now good ideas, imagination and determination, how they can be transformative very quickly and on a budget.
Yeah, they can be because of the pressures of warfare. And we've seen that in Ukraine with the Brave One system, whereby they reward frontline units with a point system and they can trade those points in for weapons coming immediately from the manufacturer straight to the frontline unit. Fedorov, the previous defence minister, who at the moment is in a bit of a limbo, he was the man that Zelensky sacked from his job recently as defence minister. But Fedorov and the people around him are full of those ideas. And it goes back to something that Emma was just saying. In a way, what the Ukrainians have developed is this sort of ecosystem. It's not just the technology, it's all the things that go with it and the other organizations and the capital and the supportive elements, both from government and private industry. It's creating an ecosystem that is able to put these technologies into a developed form and then get them to the battlefront, which is why the whole DIANA system or the DIANA initiative is really important, because as I take it anyway, Emma will correct me if I'm wrong, but it's really trying to develop this ecosystem around the whole defence business, not just a series of defence industries that government goes to.
He's not wrong, is he, Emma?
No, absolutely not. And I think that's why it's really important that it's being done as part of that broader ecosystem, and why it's being done at a NATO alliance level rather than just being done at national levels as well.
So, Emma, what sort of technologies is NATO DIANA most focused on?
It has a few different areas. It does look particularly at sort of dual use technologies. And so it has a particular focus on that. But it's really looking at those sort of early stage emerging technologies where companies may only be in the sort of science R&D phase and how that can be pulled through into sort of operational capability. So it has a reasonable focus on some of sort of energy systems and energy storage. It also looks at the sort of biotechnology sphere. And so some of the areas that Michael was talking about earlier are super interesting. And again, as has been said, some of it are things where we need to understand the science behind it and how it could be used in a defence context, just so that we can see how it could be used, maybe not necessarily by us, but by others as well. And so we could then potentially be developing countermeasures to those technologies.
And there is a UK Defence Accelerator programme as well. How do they compare, Emma?
I think it's part of a linked programme that they all kind of need to work together. The UK Defence Innovation System is undergoing a little bit of reform at the moment, as we've seen through UKDI. And so the establishment of that is trying to kind of cohere some of this innovation system together a bit more. And so on the UK side, you have DSTL, which looks at that sort of really early stage R&D development. And then hopefully the idea is that that can then link through to UKDI for more of the sort of deployment and rapid technology innovation and getting those capabilities into operational use. But the real test will be on the UK side is how UKDI does that meshing together of what's still a little bit of a patchwork of different activity across the UK and how it can cohere that and then link into things like NATO Diana to make sure that A, we're doing this strategically from a UK perspective, but also that it creates a landscape that's easier for these companies to navigate, because otherwise that can be a little bit complicated if you're starting out to know what your routes are and how you're supposed to access that support.
So from what you're saying, basically, from the UK point of view, it's still work in progress, really.
It is still a bit work in progress, yeah. There is some progress being made, but we're still yet to see the sort of fully fledged version of that coming through, and so yet to test it.
Okay, we were looking at some research from Boston Consulting Group, and it had some interesting figures. Based on numbers of academic publications, Europe is leading on research in 6 out of 9 cutting-edge defence technology areas. On AI, quantum, communication networks, Europe is ahead of not only the US, but also China. Yet turning that research into products based on patent data, we're way behind the US. Why is that, Mike?
Well, every country has got its own characteristic issues, and so our issue is not the same as everybody else's. But, I mean, everybody thinks about government spending, and in that respect, you know, we spend less than half of 1% of our GDP, officially government money, on R&D, research and development. And so if you look across the 40-odd countries that, you know, what they spend on R&D, we're in the bottom half. You know, we're way below the 20th place out of 40. So partly it's government spending, but it's not only that. It's other things as well. I mean, we're over-centralized in our regulation and too fragmented in our innovation, I think, is one of the problems we've got. So we've got innovation going on all over the place, great innovation, great science, and it comes up against this over-centralized regulatory structure, which slows it all down. That's another national problem. And then the real national problem, to my mind, is in capital. It's actually getting capital into these projects. It's commercializing them. And the problem is so often that a really good startup gets to a certain point and then it has to go abroad to find the capital to really get going. And that's the problem. You know, it's not that our base is collapsed or anything like that, but it's sliding away from the position it could be in if only we can get the capital. And I go back to government in that respect. I sound like a broken record, I know, but there's a lot of private capital out there which is very interested in defence innovation, but it won't fully commit because it doesn't think the government has fully committed yet. Yeah. And the government that, you know, this Labour government, let's say the Starmer government, didn't convince private capital that it was serious about defence. And let's hold judgment on the Burnham government because it hasn't had any time to do anything yet. And we'll see in the autumn budget what it looks like. But there is a sense out there that private capital will not commit until it thinks the government will really commit to defence. And so far it hasn't.
Something definitely to watch. Emma, I guess a big question, will accelerators do better at turning our laboratory breakthroughs into equipment in the hands of servicemen and women?
That's the aim. That's what they're there for. But ultimately, as with all these things, it does rely on governments, and not just UK government. When we're looking at the sort of the NATO side for Diana, it's other governments as well. It relies on them being that sort of anchor demand. And if governments aren't serious about it and are not spending the money, because defence is a slightly odd market where governments are the main customer, it really relies on government's behaviour to drive that. And if the markets and if companies and investors don't think that governments are serious about spending this money, then they'll put the money somewhere else.
So I was looking at the list of the 150 projects funded for the 2026 round in NATO Diana. 27 come from the UK. They include space propulsion, deepfake detection, quantum computing, a navigation system for drones when they're denied GPS. Mike, it all sounds great in the future, but do we risk having our focus a little too far in the future?
Well, it's always a danger. I mean, you've got to accept failures. When you're into this sort of frontier area of weapons development, you've got to accept that some things simply won't work and the money will be wasted. And the problem is we're so intolerant of failure that we spend too long and spend too much trying to get it right first time. We won't be able to do that. In a way, it's often said you're trying to fund unicorns, which will be something small but will turn out to be magical. And in that respect, you won't get it right every time. So there is always a danger, but you can't avoid doing it. We now live in a world of such rapid innovation that you cannot wait to let other companies and in other countries create that innovation, because they'll weaponize it and apply it, if you like, to the battle space while you're still thinking about it. Can't do it. So we've got to be prepared to take risks.
So, Emma, this 20% funding increase for the NATO accelerator, how much difference do you think it can make? And perhaps more crucially, when might it deliver tangible capabilities?
I think it will make a difference. I think if you look at the stats, like, Diana is unbelievably popular, and the acceptance rate for the number of companies that Diana can actually take forward versus the applications that they have is really low. And so if some of this funding can help support more of those companies, then that will be really important. But I think ultimately, we want to be viewing this as what the outcomes are rather than just the investment in, and how those companies can then be supported. And I think that while that funding will be really important, there is also then discussion and thought that needs to be had about what happens when companies get to the end of the Diana process and what the sort of handoff is and what their next steps are, because otherwise you run a slight risk where you have a very good program and then there's a slight cliff edge in the support that they receive. And so Diana are looking at this, but it goes back to the points that we were making earlier around the fact that we can be very good at that early stage science and R&D and innovation. But if you don't have the commercialization and you don't have the scale, you can't then develop that all the way through and have that pull through. So having that pull through at the end of the Diana process will be equally important to the support that is being given during it.
Emma, great to meet you. Thank you for joining us on SITREP, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you so much.
Well, cutting-edge technologies don't just come from startup companies. Many first emerge from universities. 35 such institutions have just formed the Defence Universities Alliance. It will work with the Ministry of Defence to improve skills and research that will support the armed forces. This is something that Dan Cook got in touch with us about, wanting to know more. So we asked the Chief Executive of Universities UK, Vivian Stern, to explain all.
It's a pretty unique partnership between 35 UK universities from all parts of the UK and the Ministry of Defence to bolt together the capability that we've got in our brilliant university system to make sure that we're making the strongest possible contribution across research and innovation and the development of sort of education and skills to the nation's defence, to making sure that, you know, we can work as a seamless partnership across all of those fields.
And if we start with the teaching part, how's this going to improve the skills available to UK Defence?
Well, I think there are two things here. The first is making sure that universities have a deep understanding of the kind of capabilities that the defence sector needs. So, you know, what is it that we need to be developing in the way of courses, both undergraduate and postgraduate courses, but also short courses, things that are adapted to helping people to retrain and upskill. And of course, that's not just a job for the university system. I think we've got to work in partnership with the college sector and with the defence industry. But it's also, I guess, about making sure that we're sharing what universities are doing in defence and innovation so that the MOD and defence sector generally can see which way the wind is blowing. They can see the kind of capabilities that are coming down the line, and they can then think, okay, well, what are we going to need in terms of, you know, our human resources in order to make the best use of that? Because it's pretty clear, I'm no expert in this, but it's pretty clear this is a field that's changing so fast. Mm. And therefore the kind of skills and competences we're going to need in the defence workforce are going to also change.
And university research feeding into defence, presumably this happens already. So how does this alliance affect that?
Well, I guess, you know, the way we see it is making this more than the sum of its individual parts. So as you say, there are many universities that have existing collaborations with parts of the military. So Plymouth, for example, which is the University of Plymouth, which is one of the members of this alliance, has a hugely well-established partnership with the Royal Navy. You've got universities that have got really, really strong connections with the Air Force, for example, in the kind of aerospace and, you know, all of the kind of technology that underpins our air defence. But what we are trying to do here, I suppose, is make sure that this set of institutions works as a team. And it's also about making sure that if the MOD sees a capability gap or they see a sort of operational challenge and they don't quite know where to turn to find the people with the expertise and the insight that can help them tackle that problem, they can reach out to the whole network. They don't have to go to one door and find out whether yes or no there's somebody in that individual university that can work on this problem. They can reach into a huge pool of expertise. And it's not just in the sort of the disciplines you might think about, like, for example, engineering. You know, there are lots of capabilities that will be found in parts of universities that won't naturally have a relationship with the MOD. So it's about making sure it's easy to find people who can help work on whatever the problem is.
And yet universities are really stretched at the moment, aren't they? And we all know that. Is the resource actually there to deliver on this? For example, is there extra money ring-fenced for it all?
Well, government's put £80 million into additional skills development in the defence sector, which I think is really, really welcome. We've got already quite a lot of investment going in, both from government, from the MOD, and actually also from universities themselves, into research and innovation in the defence space. But I think this is about trying to layer it up and make sure that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
And you obviously need the right people to benefit from the learning and conduct the research. Is there a particular space in this for either serving personnel or veterans?
I absolutely hope that's the way that it's going to work, that it's already the case when you think about the way that universities work with the armed forces and the MOD and industry partners, that we need people who are in the, you know, active in the field to inform what's happening in the lab, inform what's happening in the classroom. And I hope we'll be able to build on that, and that will be much stronger kind of flow between one and the other space. Because, you know, frankly, I think one of the things I love about the university sector is that it's a place where people come together and they share what they know, and then they try and pass it on to other people. I mean, it's as simple as that. And some of what we need to understand, that knowledge and that experience, it lies out there in the people who we're talking to today.
And we've heard plenty of warnings that time is of the essence to deliver on this and to strengthen defence. How quickly could the alliance be delivering meaningful improvements to UK defence?
Oh, I think pretty quickly. As I say, it's not something that's starting from nothing. All of the universities that are part of this alliance have got existing collaborations either with the armed forces or the MOD or with defence industry partners. What I think will change is that we'll get a degree of kind of agility and very quick information flow between parts of the system. Okay, here's what we're working on today. This is what we need. Who can come and help us with this? And I think that will accelerate innovation. It'll accelerate our sector's ability to respond to the kind of needs of the front line. And I think that will be really positive.
Really interesting. How much link does the alliance have to defence industry? Because research breakthroughs are only useful, actually, if they can be turned into reality, aren't they?
Yeah, and as I say, I think that whilst this is a partnership with the MOD, there are lots of collaborations that exist currently with major defence sector industry partners. And I think that this is a structure that will enable us to join those dots. I think that sometimes the university system is perceived as being, you know, a little bit kind of reluctant to think about the role that we play in the nation's security. I guess part of what we as Universities UK want to do through our support for the Defence Universities Alliance is just underline how important we think this is and why we think that universities have a very important role to play in stepping up to support the nation's defence.
And to that point, the academics are all on board, are they?
Well, look, we've got, I would say you've probably got about 3 million people either studying or working in universities, and they're delightfully disputatious places, and there'll be people with lots of views. And of course, we do expect that there will be people who believe that universities shouldn't have anything to do with defence and security. And, you know, we are places where you have to support freedom of speech, and there will be protests. But do you know what? We're also saying this is not only a legitimate part of universities' activity, it's our national responsibility to be involved in the nation's security, and we're here for that.
So good to speak to you, Vivian Stern. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
So Mike, you worked in universities for many years, and you're still a visiting professor at King's College and Exeter University, which are both part of this alliance. How much were universities already contributing to defence thinking and capability?
Well, not enough, I think. I mean, Vivian Stern was very honest in a way there. She's saying, look, you know, there has been a resistance in the past for the universities to work with Ministry of Defence. And there was a resistance of MOD to take universities very seriously, to be honest. There was too big a gap. And I lived through many years when that was the case. And what the universities were doing and what the MOD was interested in was policy questions. They wanted people, you know, like me to talk about defence policy and historical examples and so on, which is fine. And that was, we'd like to think, valuable, but there wasn't enough technological crossover between military requirement and MOD forward thinking and defence industries and what was going on in the universities. And that's why this Defence University Alliance will be important, if it can bring in those, the technological side and the building of skills, the workforce, that's really important. And you know, this thing began, I mean, 100 universities submitted to the DUA idea and 35 were chosen. Originally, the MOD only thought they'd have 6 or 8 or then 12. Yeah. They've ended up with 35, which indicates that there's more expertise out there than the MOD probably thought there would be. And, you know, I was looking at the universities that used to be involved heavily with the more technological side. You know, Vivian Stern mentioned there, Plymouth, but you could add to that, you know, Queen's Belfast, Strathclyde. They're all maritime. They're all marine. They're all where shipbuilding was. And that's what their expertise was in. Then there was Cranfield. And Cranfield was always a you know, the University of Technology. And that was always across the board. And Cranfield is now being merged with King's College, which, you know, I'm a visiting professor at King's. If it wasn't for the matter of titles, we'd call King's College a National Defence University. We won't ever call it that, but that's what it is. That's in the United States. Yeah. King's would be the National Defence University. So I think the MOD's discovered a wider range of expertise, technological expertise out there than it might have imagined.
And that just really shows what they've been missing out on, because their expectations were so surpassed in terms of those that have signed up for it. And I mean, the important thing, I suppose, is can it deliver significant improvements to the sharp end where it really does matter?
Well, I think that's the issue. I don't think there'll be any huge breakthroughs to which you'll be able to say, oh, this is a DUA initiative. But what it may well produce, what I hope it produces, is a bigger flow of skilled workforce, people with technical knowledge from the universities who see that within this defence ecosystem that we were talking about earlier on, that there are useful roles for them to play and good jobs, good careers out there. And I think if it produces a workforce, a spike in the skilled workforce, it will have done its job.
You know, I really hope Dan Cook, who put that question to us that sparked this whole discussion, heard all of this and is satisfied. Yeah. It's satisfied his curiosity. Thank you for that question.
Well done, Dan Cook.
And anyone else who wants to send in questions, the way you do it is your email is sitrep@bfbs.com or you can leave a comment on the podcast. So look forward to reading more. Mike, I want to talk about overspill from the Ukraine war now. Last week, we mentioned the missile that came down in Poland, nearly 60 miles from the Ukrainian border. Poland says it was a Russian KH-101. Now we have an explosive drone found close to a runway at Leipzig Airport in Germany. While Leipzig Airport was closed by the incident, a cargo plane diverting to Hanover hit an object in the air. Mike, German authorities aren't publicly pointing the finger. They're handling it with a counter-terrorism investigation hat on. But Russia is surely the prime suspect here.
Yes, I'd be astonished if anyone else was involved, because this was pretty expert. This is not an amateur's job. This drone, the way it was configured, it seems, was obviously done with a purpose and by professionals. It was only by some good luck that it was discovered before it was able to explode. Everything points to what the Russians are doing. And the point is that the Russians, because they are struggling now at the war, and Russia is now making a determined effort to intercept all of the aid and the help which Europe is presently giving to Ukraine, as well as to frighten the Europeans into stop giving so much aid to Ukraine, and, you know, thirdly, to test Western responses to see where the weaknesses are. So there are lots of reasons why the Russians have stepped up this sub-threshold warfare, which they're conducting against pretty well all West European countries at the moment, but particularly Germany, some of the Baltic states, the Scandinavian countries, and the United Kingdom.
And that drone at Leipzig Airport ended up only causing disruption, but if it had detonated, we'd be in a very different situation, wouldn't we?
Yeah, and we're just waiting for that to happen. I mean, in the sense that we won't be lucky every time. And with the incidence of these sorts of events, the fact that they're occurring on every couple of weeks, there's a new one. I'd be surprised if we get through to the end of the year without something much nastier happening that will be harder, where much more difficult for us to control the effects of it, the political effects.
And this is a balancing act for NATO. Despite a missile landing in its territory and what looks like a failed explosive drone attack, it's diplomatically pretty quiet. At what point does diplomatic restraint look like weakness?
That's always the balance which NATO policymakers and leaders are trying to strike. That you don't want to seem to panic. You don't want to panic the public. You want to make sure the Russians know that we know and that we understand what's going on. But if you don't make more of a fuss than we are making at the moment, then the message doesn't get through to the Russians that there will be consequences. We say there will. So far, there haven't really been any consequences. And that's the dilemma. I mean, I wouldn't like to have to make those decisions, because by and large, we're making the decisions on the quieter side of diplomacy. And that's probably the right thing to do. But there comes a point where you simply have to elevate it, because this behaviour will continue until somehow it is curtailed or stopped.
And in that case, in Germany, it's worth pointing out here that Leipzig is used for cargo going to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Do you think it might have been targeted at attack for that reason?
Oh, I'm sure it was, yeah. I mean, in my own mind, I'd be amazed if that wasn't part of the rationale. That what the Russians are trying to do is to intercept and interfere with the transmission of all these forms of transport and aid that is going from Western countries, from Germany, from Poland in particular, into Ukraine. They make constant attempts to interfere with it, as you'd expect. And those attempts don't just occur now within inside Ukraine's borders. Increasingly, it's a matter of sabotage and subversion in Western countries before the stuff even gets into Ukraine.
So does NATO actually have red lines for this overspill? And if so, what are they?
Well, there's a real issue there, Kate, because as any senior civil servant would tell us, once, I mean, and I've heard a senior civil servant say, you have to say to a minister, you know, minister, the public want red lines spelled out. Journalists always say, spell out your red lines. But if you do that, minister, you're telling the opposition what they can and can't do. Because once you establish a red line, the opposition will go right up to it, because they know that's where the line is. And they'll play games with it, because you've established what you will and won't do when they're taking those initiatives. So there is always a trade-off between being clear about red lines, but indicating alternatively that there are red lines and you'll know when you've crossed them. And I think that's where we are with NATO at the moment. NATO is saying, look, there are red lines. You will know when you've crossed them. We will demonstrate it. But it is frustrating for the public because it looks like indecision. It isn't. It is a form of policy, because red lines can actually make the situation worse because you're giving the opposition too much information.
So reddish lines, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, well, I'd say red line zones. You need to say this is in a red line zone.
Okay.
And you know, you say to the Russians, you are playing with fire doing this. You know, we are minded to make this into a red line. We're thinking about it, and the Russians would need to understand that.
So, at what point would you expect a response?
It's hard to say, but I mean, as we've said before on the programme, these things are building up, and I'd be surprised if we get through to the end of this year without something becoming much more serious than it's been so far. I think the effects are cumulative. NATO intends to be more muscular. Partly we lack the facilities to be muscular in a decisive way, because you've got to be able to overawe the opposition at the point of contact. Wherever the issue is, whatever the problem is, and it could be lots of things on the ground or in the air, at sea, you've got to be able to actually bring force together in order to say to the other side, don't even think about escalating, don't even think about it. And it's not clear that we've got the right sort of forces to do that at the moment. Nevertheless, I think we're moving to a situation where NATO is going to have to say, that was a red line, you've crossed it, and these are the consequences. And then we'll have to live with the escalation that may then occur because of it. We're getting quite close to that.
Yeah, plenty to go away and think about. Mike, thank you for that. And thank you to all of our guests. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Between now and then, you can stay up to date via our website, forcesnews.com. From me, Kate Jabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.